It's time for Skin in the Game, and we have your front row seat to the action with marketing expert John Simperman and sports business journalist Tim Oshai.
They're talking about a $1 billion renovation.
Which is incredible.
And that's
for a hockey arena in the South, too, right?
That includes hotels.
Skin in the Game brings you the fresh and fascinating business news in the world of sports, a multi-billion dollar industry that has an economic impact on all of us.
This week, John and I talked to Danny Funt, the author of Everybody Loses, about the true cost of sports gaming.
The NFL was very strict with any league employees. Don't step foot in a casino. We don't even want you seen playing slots or what have you. And then fast forward a few years ago, the game was played at what's now Caesars Superdome in New Orleans.
Right.
And they have the NFL logo stamped on blackjack tables at Caesars casinos. So it's just incredible how different things are than just a few years ago.
Coming up next on Skin in the Game, right after this.
Support for BTPM comes from our members and from Holiday Valley. Holiday Valley has winter fun everyone can agree on. Holiday Valley was voted the number 4 resort in the East by Ski Magazine readers. Holiday Valley features mountain coaster rides, snow tubing, the Tamarack Club Spa, and of course, skiing and snowboarding. At Holiday Valley, you can just relax too. Winter starts here. More information at holidayvalley.com.
Hey, welcome to a new episode of Skin in the Game. I'm your host, John Simperman, with my co-host,
Tim Oshai.
Hey, Tim, wanted to again thank Holiday Valley for being our presenting sponsor of Skin in the Game. And as ski season wraps up, just a reminder that it's a four-season resort, and this might be the time for you to go out because ski season's over.
Yeah, ropes course.
Ropes course. And all the accommodations. So,
although it's snowing outside today, so...
Well, this,
like when do we get in, straight across the Northeast, by the way?
That's right.
It's so just gotta, eventually we'll get to that ropes course.
That's right. But again, thanks to Holiday Valley for being our partner on this Skin in the Game. Also, Tim, I wanted to thank you for bringing in what I think is a great guest and a very important subject, that being sports betting.
John, we've got Danny Funt coming on the show today. The author of Everybody Loses, and what an incredible book.
So, and this is a recent release of this book.
Yeah, it's a brand new, well, close to a brand new book, last couple of months. Yeah, you know, I mean, Danny's been all over the place talking about this. I was running on a treadmill the other day, and, you know, the TV on the treadmill, there's Danny Funt on CNN.
Yeah.
Very happy to have him on Skin in the Game. And you talk about going a deep dive into the impact of sports gaming. Everybody Loses really takes you inside that big, complicated, and growing piece of the sports industry.
Yeah, you know, and complicated is a great way to phrase it because, you know, it is complicated. And now you cannot turn on the radio, the television, any streaming service, any sports broadcast without being inundated with messaging and promotions from these sports gambling sites.
Yeah, that is so true and so different from, you know, it feels like just a few years ago. It's a little bit more than that, though. 2018 is when sports gaming, you know, it was legalized, you know, more broadly, right? It's been in Vegas forever. You know, seven years ago, the Supreme Court, almost 8 years ago, the Supreme Court made a decision that then just opened it wide. And it's been probably one of the biggest changes, maybe the biggest change in the sports industry
in the last decade. You know, I'm going to ask Danny because the title of his book is Everybody Loses, but you know, it seems like there might be some winners, and those are the television networks and the sports teams who have now driven incremental new revenue with this sponsorship category.
Yeah, they have. And I mean, making it available, depending on the state you're sitting in, to fans in the seats. You know who else is winning too is the sports book sites too, right? The actual betting companies.
Oh, you don't mean that it's going to go 50-50?
It's not a charity?
No, it's a for-profit business. Yeah, just like when
a little bit.
Yeah, when you go to Las Vegas and you wonder how can they pay for all these extravagant hotels, doesn't the guests sometimes win?
Yeah, it's like, really? They're going to comp my room? I'm talking about Vegas. Yeah, because you're comping them a whole lot of cash.
Yeah. Well, in all seriousness, I think it is a very important topic. I do, and as I'll kind of probe my questions with our guest, you know, I think there is way, way more negatives. And I hope there is ways that we can really focus on putting guardrails on sport betting to make sure that, A, you know, the livelihoods of a lot of people who unfortunately lose money gambling, but also the integrity of the game and the whole reason we enjoy sport. I really hope we can fix some things.
You know, and a big one that jumps out to me, John, is the safety of the athletes and the coaches, too. And I mean both emotionally and physically,
right,
too. And it's quite common for them to have threats because they scored one too many points, or they made a basket, they stepped out of the game.
Or they got taken out of the game because of whatever it might be. So I get it. So, you know, very important conversation. Danny Funt, the author of Everybody Loses, is coming up here shortly. But speaking of winning, got some really great news. If you're a WNBA player, they have approved the new collective bargaining agreement, and they will be hitting the court the middle of April. And as reported, the minimum salary of a WNBA player actually goes up to $270,000 a year, which, Tim, the maximum salary a WNBA player made last year was $250,000. So really looks like a really good deal for the players and, you know, also a good deal for the fans of the WNBA.
Yeah, well deserved. Not high enough. I mean, I'm sure, you know, there are many people, and I'll be one, who will say not nearly high enough. Like, that's got to, I mean, again, compare it to the to men's basketball, and the chasm is, what, several Grand Canyons wide. So there's a lot of room to grow and a lot of work to go, but this was a major, major step. So I'm glad they got the deal. Glad that, you know, we're going to be able to continue the momentum here, and the, you know,
right,
WNBA players will be taking the court this spring.
Right.
Because I remember sitting in this room, what, a month ago, and wondering if that's going to happen.
Wondering if there was going to be a season. Exactly. So, yeah, you know, that's a big step, because I think the other things that came out of that deal is the team's salary cap. Each team had up to, in the previous deal, $1.5 million to spread over all of the player salaries, which isn't a lot.
No.
Now it's increased to $7 million.
Right.
So more money's going into the player pool, which is great. The players also have a percentage of the gross revenue. And that's the key, because, Tim, you mentioned there's still a gap between the men's game and the women's game. Yes, there is a gap. There's a gross revenue gap. But the closer that can come and the more revenue, ticket sales, sponsorship, broadcast fees that the league can generate, then it's a matter of more money can go back to the players.
Right. These women are so incredibly good at promoting their sport.
Right.
Right. So,
and that gives them the incentive to do it.
Exactly.
They have a piece of the pie.
Yeah. Put it in their hands. Put that, you know, that financial ball in their hands and watch them go do even more with it. So I'm excited to see that.
Yeah. Yeah. So great news for WNBA and great news for the fans, and a few new teams coming on board this season. So great for them as well. But before we get to our guest, Danny, one other quick news item. Our friends up in Hamilton, they do have their AHL team coming. The team, the Bridgeport Islanders, will be moving from Bridgeport,
Connecticut.
To our friends up in Hamilton at the new building. So American Hockey League back in a hockey hotbed.
Yeah, which is great. And I don't think you could oversaturate Southern Ontario with great hockey options.
Yeah.
And, you know, the AHL has not been one of those options, right?
Right.
For, you know, at least in Hamilton.
Yeah, and it's great news for the, by the way, first of all, I do feel bad for the team and the fans in Bridgeport.
Yeah,
because they're losing an asset, but they were averaging just over 4,000 fans a game. This team now will be going to Hamilton in the newly renovated TD Coliseum with a seating capacity of 18,000.
Right, so they could double, triple, quadruple that.
So it seems
to
make sense.
And certainly, certainly will. So
right.
It's heartbreaking. I'm thinking back, John, to our conversation about a year ago now with Will Bardenwerper, the author of a great book about the Batavia Muck Dogs minor league baseball team, and they lost their franchise.
Right.
And it just, you know, it broke hearts in that city, right? And eventually they got it back through the form of a college wood bat baseball league team.
Right.
But there's a lot of stories out there. Sorry, Bridgeport will be going through it, but thrilled at the same time for Hamilton.
Yeah, no, it's a great hockey market, and they needed a team back there. So it works out. hopefully our friends in Bridgeport will find another minor league hockey team, fill up that building. But we might now have to make a road trip up to Hamilton and watch a game up there.
I mean, I think we were doing it anyway, but now, it'll be for some hockey, yeah. Which I like.
Yeah. Well, hey, with that, let's wrap up this segment, and we're going to be right back with our guest, Danny Funt, who is the author of Everybody Loses. Stay tuned for that.
Support for BTPM comes from our members and from Holiday Valley. Whether it's a beginner's or Black Diamond Trail, Holiday Valley features skiing and terrain at every level. There's also a team of snow sports instructors available to sharpen your skills and build your confidence. Holiday Valley was voted the number 4 resort in the East by Ski Magazine readers. Winter starts here. More information at holidayvalley.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Skin in the Game. Danny Funt, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We are so happy to have you. John and I have been talking about diving into sports gaming, which, by the way, I appreciate you call it what it is, sports gambling, in the book, and you describe that in the book. But we're so excited to talk with you about Everybody Loses. We'll start with the basics, though. What motivated you to spend what I've got to assume is, you know, years digging into sports gambling and, you know, uncovering what you did?
I'd say two things. One was this fundamental question of why was it that the leagues changed their tune on gambling so dramatically and so suddenly? As you'll recall, you know, for a century, basically, they described gambling as an evil that was an existential threat to their games. Bud Selig, barely a decade ago, said it would destroy sports if expanded outside of Nevada. So things changed so abruptly, and I didn't really feel like their explanations were completely satisfying, and I wanted to get to the bottom of what exactly caused that change of heart. The other thing was just that as these sports betting operators like FanDuel and DraftKings have become household names and advertise so incessantly whenever you watch a game, I'd been covering them for years, and yet I felt like they were still kind of mysterious. I didn't really know what it was like to work at a company like that. I wanted to know how they talk about their customers, how they respond to some of the criticisms people have, how they think their business will continue evolving. So taking the time it took to write a book and cultivating a lot of sources inside those companies was a top priority for me.
Yeah. And Danny, you're so right on with the whole, 10, 15 years ago, if you recall, there were no professional teams in Vegas for this reason, right? The NBA and the NFL were not even allowed to play really exhibition games in the market because of gambling. Fast forward to where we are today, we're hosting Super Bowls, we're hosting NBA All-Star games, and now coming up, we'll have 4 major league teams in Las Vegas. So yeah, things have changed quickly.
I'll say, I mean, you could choose so many examples to illustrate that. One I like is not the most recent Super Bowl in New Orleans, but the one before that. I think it was sometime in the 2000s. The NFL was very strict with any league employees. Don't step foot in a casino. Forget sports betting. We don't even want you seen playing slots or what have you. And then fast forward a few years ago, the game was played at what's now Caesars Superdome in New Orleans. Right. And they have the NFL logo stamped on blackjack tables at Caesars casinos. So it's just incredible how different things are than just a few years ago.
Danny, the book, of course, is called Everybody Loses. Does everybody really lose?
I think so, especially when you think about this in broader terms than just money. Because, yeah, people are losing a ton of money now that Americans are betting more than $150 billion every year legally. But beyond all that money, sports is losing faith in the integrity of their games. We're seeing that on such a mainstream level now when there's one fixing scandal after another. A lot of sports media is losing its independence. And I get into in the book why sports journalists are concerned that they and their companies might be pulling punches because they don't want to upset some of their top advertisers. When you think about public health and even the economic impacts of so much gambling happening, that losing is staggering, and where it's headed in the near future is pretty frightening to think about. So It's losing on a really profound and broad scale. And then the follow-up question I ask in the book is, who exactly is winning? And I think that's maybe an even tougher question to answer.
Yeah, you know, Danny, I mentioned to Tim here before we got on the podcast with you, I said somewhat facetiously, well, the leagues are winning because sponsorship dollars and TV dollars. But listening to you, yeah, those are short-term gains and big financial gains. But to your point about integrity and to your point about where this goes long-term, it could be everybody loses, right?
Yeah, and as far as the leagues are concerned, I agree with you. It's such a short-term gambit. You know, yes, it increases their TV audience considerably to have so many people betting, and there's very persuasive data that gamblers watch way more sports than casual fans. That was one of the things that persuaded the leagues, I found, was the gambling industry presenting all these studies they commissioned that demonstrated just how much more gamblers watch compared to traditional fans. But beyond that, you know, forget how much money their fans are losing, and maybe some of them will feel like it's too expensive to be a fan nowadays, or young people who are, you know, gambling at unprecedented rates, if they'll burn out and lose interest in sports. You've also got the danger that athletes are facing now. And I get into that to start the book and to end the book, because I really think this is a huge, terrifying story. The scourge of harassment that athletes now get practically on a game-by-game basis whenever they cost someone a bet, and just have to deal with the rage that gamblers can generate. And the harassments are, and all the abuse they get online is disturbing enough, but it really seems like the threat of violence is real and imminent. You've had people arrested for death threats. The manager of the San Diego Padres, Mike Schilt, resigned this past season because he said he was so fed up with the nonstop death threats. JB Bickerstaff, the coach of the Pistons, has said people have texted him about saying they know who his kids are and where he lives. That's pretty scary. So all of that is, again, losing on yet another level. And the leagues are going to have to defend that because it's kind of the trade-off they've accepted.
We're not talking just professional coaches and players either here, right, Danny? I mean, we're talking college players, who college athletes, college coaches, who, you know, in the case of the athletes, short of some massive NIL deal, are not being paid a ton of money to do this. I mean, they're still doing it for the love of the game and maybe a college scholarship.
Yeah, that's interesting you bring up NIL, because with pro sports, certainly, and with college sports, you hear the argument that today's athletes make too much money to be tempted by gambling or trying to fix games. We know that's ridiculous. I mean, Pete Rose was briefly the highest paid player in team sports when he was betting on the Reds. Phil Mickelson's made $1 billion in his golf career. He's admitted that he had a gambling problem that reportedly cost him hundreds of millions of dollars. So money does not, you know, immunize you from wanting to be tempted by betting. In fact, athletes are known to be pretty ardent gamblers. But NIL creates a kind of wealth gap in college sports, where obviously not everyone's making a ton of money. And just a few days before my book came out, there was this allegation that a couple of dozen college men's basketball programs were accused of fixing games in collusion with gamblers. And prosecutors said that these fixers went after lower level teams where they're not making as much in NIL. And you could imagine there could be quite a bit of jealousy when you're playing against people who are well off and you're, you know, struggling to get by. And they said, hey, we'll give you 10 grand up to 40 grand a game if you help us shave points. And that was persuasive to these student athletes. So really all the dangers that we talk about with gambling and its effect on sports are magnified when it comes to college.
Yeah. And Danny, our listeners know, but you may not know, I'm a Cleveland Guardians fan, have been all my life. And, you know, many of our listeners may not realize that, you know, the star pitcher, the star closer, arguably up for a Cy Young Award as a closer, is obviously now under serious investigation and suspension from Major League Baseball. Needless to say, he was very well paid. So, you know, whether it's a young college athlete who's not making a lot, or in this case, a multimillionaire, all these athletes are susceptible to these outside forces, and the accessibility and the ease now to make a bet or to have someone make a bet on your behalf.
Yeah, his story is so revealing. Emmanuel Clase, the Guardians closer. For one, the idea that he could and his partners could make a lot of money allegedly fixing individual pitches. It's such a byproduct of online betting, and about 95% of this business is conducted online, and it allows just whole categories of betting that never used to exist. Obviously, if you have to phone a bookie or wait in line at a Vegas casino, you can't bet on, will the next pitch be a ball or a strike? And yet that's a big growth area in the online business, and he's accused of tipping off people saying, hey, I'm going to spike a slider when I lead, you know, start facing the next batter, be sure to bet that I'll throw a ball. I found it interesting initially, the MLB and the prosecutors who'd investigated him said this was just a few games that had been corrupted. And I think last week, ESPN reported that 48 games are now thought to have been rigged by Clase. So it's indicative of the fact you can bet in all these ways. Major League Baseball, when he was charged, sounded kind of aghast, like, wow, things have gotten so out of hand that you can bet on a lot of money on pitches. It turns out that's what one of the main things that won them over was the idea that the leisurely pace of play and the pauses between pitches and batters would be a great opportunity to get people betting a lot during games. And then just lastly, it's strange. Why did it take so long for baseball to flag Class A and put him on leave? You know, 48 games over two seasons is a long time to be getting away with illegal betting, allegedly. And one of the main selling points for legalization was that they would very quickly be able to detect suspicious bets, intervene so that something like this wouldn't happen. This isn't the first time a conspicuous amount of time passed before anything was done. When Terry Rozier last year, the Miami Heat guard, was arrested for allegedly fixing his prop bets, those games had taken place seasons earlier when he was on a whole different team before he was traded. So the NBA had to explain what took so long, and I think baseball is going to have to address that same question, because that's not how they sold the upside of legalization.
So I grew up a Cincinnati Reds fan, and I was a huge, huge, huge fan of Pete Rose, and I appreciate him, you know, how in Everybody Loses you describe, you know, what goes behind that Charlie Hustle nickname that Pete had, and diving headfirst into bases, and you know, just really being the epitome of a player who worked hard and play hard, and you know, and then obviously we all found out, if we're old enough to remember, how the play hard happened off the field too, right? And my question for you, and you, I know you get into this in the book a little bit on the Pete Rose example, is there anything similar between the way a gambler thinks and the way an athlete thinks that would drive somebody like, not Pete Rose specifically, but somebody with Pete Rose's money and success to still want to go gamble money on a game that they're playing in, or any game at all that they're supposed to be staying far away from?
Oh, no question. For one, just being a maniacal competitor and loving, you know, that adrenaline rush that comes with that. I mean, who's more competitive than Michael Jordan?
Exactly.
And his gambling track record is well documented. I mean, I hadn't heard this story of when he was on the Bulls and he was playing with some NHL player and was getting beat pretty bad on the golf course and said, I forget the specifics, but it was something like, hey, double or nothing, I drop 40 in tonight's game. And the double or nothing was dealing with a lot of money. And sure, you know, knowing Michael Jordan, he won that side of the bet and got his money back. But, you know, he's well known to bet a huge amount of money on the golf course and at casinos. You hear that about a lot of athletes. There was a former agent named David Meltzer, I think, who told me he's been in private card rooms where athletes were playing the game War for seven figures, just the most mindless card game you could think of, and millions of dollars on the line. Everything about being a successful athlete, you know, not accepting defeat, loving the rush of competition, believing in yourself despite the odds, all of that is a recipe for trouble when it comes to gambling. And it's why it's so well documented that athletes are prone to gambling problems.
Yeah. We're here with Danny Funt, the author of Everybody Loses. Earlier on, I touched on who might, at least in the short term, be winning. And these are the leagues and the teams with sponsorship revenue. And Danny, in your book, you talk a little bit about how these platforms, FanDuel, DraftKings, whatever, leverages these sponsorships with the teams to provide quote-unquote VIP experiences to these gamblers. And I was amazed. I'd love to hear from you. Some of these people who are spending money and getting these VIP experiences aren't necessarily kind of the big rollers. This is kind of a scary path to go down. So if you could talk a little bit about who some of these VIPs are who are part of these quote-unquote sponsorship experiences.
Sure. This had to be my favorite chapter of the book, mainly because, as I said, I'd been covering this for a while. I had no idea what a big part of the business this is, and also just the things that quote-unquote VIP customers have access to as a sports fan. It would be like a dream come true. I spoke with a lot of people who've been hosts. Each of these companies has hundreds of employees whose job is to cater to these VIP customers, people betting thousands of bucks a week and sometimes much, much more than that. There was one VIP in, I think it was New Jersey, who is thought to have lost more than $100 million. He's probably the biggest loser in the online betting era. All I could figure out about him is he's someone who has inherited oil wealth. I couldn't actually put a name to him, but you know, that shows you that that's about as big a whale as you can find. But these customers, about 2% of sports bettors contribute about 60 or 70% of revenue. And as a result, I was saying they get access to throwing out the first pitch at a Major League Baseball game, having your kids take batting practice on the big league field, playing pickup on an NBA court, giving the starting command at a NASCAR race. I heard about a PGA championship on Long Island where the sportsbook flew in their VIPs via helicopter and they landed on the golf course to get to watch that event. Everything you could dream of. It's a big reason why sportsbooks pay millions to partner with teams. Yeah. I always assumed that was just an advertising deal and maybe to lend some legitimacy to a particular betting company. In fact, it's mainly to gain access to all these ways of catering to your VIPs. But as you were saying, the argument is, oh, these are ultra rich people. They can afford to lose a ton of money. It's no big deal to them. For one, you could definitely have a gambling problem even if you can afford to be losing so much money. It might not be a good idea to be betting constantly and betting all that money. But beyond that, they are definitely not vetting these customers, even at a very basic level, to make sure they can afford to be betting at such a staggering rate. To give you one example of that, I interviewed a former VIP in Connecticut who lost $100,000 in a year with FanDuel. Mm-hmm. You know, as I'm talking to him and hearing about that, he's now in recovery, by the way, for a gambling problem. And he said, I was hooked on the betting. I was also definitely hooked on those VIP perks, and not wanting to relinquish that status delayed me getting the help I needed. But as he was telling me about that, I was thinking of what I had heard again and again from these companies, that they make sure to vet these customers. So I said, what were you doing for a living while you lost $100,000 in a year at FanDuel? And he said, I was a server at the Cheesecake Factory making $65,000 a year. And obviously FanDuel never once asked what his job was, never did anything to check that he could afford to lose six figures in a year. He's not alone. Sadly, that happens all the time. Basically, every person I've spoken with who's in recovery for a sports betting problem told me they had access to VIP perks at one time or another. It's such a fraught side of the business because you're egging on a crazy amount of betting. And also because these hosts are responsible for intervening if someone seems like they have a problem. And yet what I heard is there's so much pressure to look the other way because these are your most valuable customers. And if you cut them off, you might not make your boss too happy.
Right. Well, Danny, on that note, I don't know if you saw recently, the governor of Ohio, Mike DeWine, says he absolutely regrets approving online betting in the state of Ohio. I believe they went live in 2021. Is there any way, I don't want to kind of cut to the chase here, but is there any way to put the toothpaste back in the tube here? I mean, what do we do going forward?
Well, one thing Governor DeWine is calling for, and you're hearing about more and more, is banning prop bets, these bets on individual play. For one, because it's so much easier to corrupt a bet, to fix a game if all you have to do is make sure you don't score a certain number of points or grab a certain number of rebounds or what have you. But also just because it's so easy to get carried away if you're betting at that granular level. And if you're placing those sorts of bets throughout a game, people just find they're betting way more than they intended. So that's something DeWine has pushed for. Mm-hmm. It's an easier sell with college sports just because the idea of putting college athletes under that kind of microscope seems wrong to a lot of people. Whereas with pro sports, it's harder to convince lawmakers and gaming commissions to get on board with that. It's also the industry's biggest moneymaker, so they're putting up a huge fight to stop that. But, you know, the idea of putting the toothpaste back in the tube, I get that that sounds difficult. I don't think a lot of states will revert to prohibition. But the thing is, they don't have to. In fact, I think the industry likes to oversimplify this argument to legalize or to not legalize, because there's a lot of compelling arguments for legalization. There's also a lot of compelling arguments for a whole host of consumer protections that are on the table that the industry opposes. Things like restricting advertising so that kids aren't overexposed, restricting deceptive promotions so that people aren't seduced into betting because they think they're getting a bunch of free money when the fine print says otherwise, restricting types of bets that are a pathway to compulsive behavior. The list goes on. A lot of this has been implemented, particularly in Europe, where online sports betting has been around longer. And they look at the US and think we're crazy to allow some of that stuff. And I get the sense, talking with people in this business for my book, that some of them think a crackdown like that is, it's a matter of time. And their game plan is, let's extract as much as we can from Americans before lawmakers decide to tighten the guardrails. It's going to be an uphill battle, though. There's so much money fighting from the other side of that equation.
Danny, how much of a lobbying presence, how much lobbying might do the sports books have at the, you know, at a state-to-state level and, of course, at the federal level?
It's massive. Not only is it massive, but what is the other side? You know, yeah, there's some addiction advocacy groups. You know, they're a speck of dust compared to the billions and billions of dollars that the industry is spending. This was so pronounced in the states were rushing to legalize, and the industry and the sports leagues were so active in lobbying. I remember speaking with a lobbyist in Virginia who was part of this national campaign, and she was telling me how proud she was that she basically got everything done that her clients, mainly FanDuel and DraftKings and the leagues, had been pushing for. And I remember asking, there had to have been some one thing you didn't get, right? One thing that lawmakers just didn't go for. And she thought about it for a minute and said, no, not really. We really got everything we asked for. I also just can't stress enough how impactful the leagues, not just participation, but how hands-on they were. This was huge with sports betting, where team owners and retired greats were schmoozing with lawmakers. And, you know, that was very persuasive because it was easy for them to get meetings, definitely a lot easier than it is for a gambling company to spend a lot of time with a politician. But also, in the daily fantasy era, when FanDuel and DraftKings got this foothold that allowed them to be the dominant players when sports betting took off, I cover in the book how New York was on the verge of banning daily fantasy. And this might have been a death blow to the industry because if he can't operate in New York, that's going to have really bad consequences elsewhere in the country. And the operators hired Jim Kelly and Vinny Testaverde and gave them a lot of money to lobby in Albany. And those lawmakers were just gaga to spend time with those two quarterbacks. And by the end of that, they said, yeah, we're going to legitimize daily fantasy. You got it.
How common is it for the companies to actually hire athletes or other people of notoriety to go meet with lawmakers and advocate directly?
The state, I think it happened all over the country, mainly via Major League Baseball and the NBA. I highlighted in the book Illinois, just because that was a big state and a big turning point, and Illinois does a lot of business with sports betting. And thanks to the cooperation of the Bulls and the White Sox, certain swing vote lawmakers got to attend a private shoot-around for the Bulls where Tony Kukoc dropped by and hung out with them for a bit. Horace Grant visited Springfield to meet some more lawmakers and show off some of his championship rings. They got to sit in a suite during a Bulls game. They also got to go to the White Sox stadium, and I forget who, maybe Frank Thomas or some White Sox legends were there to greet them. That just had such a big impact. You know, as one of the lobbyists put it, these guys don't grow up with gambling pennants on their walls. You know, they're not dreaming of being a card dealer. They idolize athletes. And so, yeah, they were so enthusiastic to not just grant them meetings, but to hear them out as they pushed for the model legislation that had been drafted by the sports books. And that was hugely influential, as we saw, you know, all over the place.
And Danny, I could see it from the team and the league perspective, because, you know, not only, as you mentioned, is it driving revenues because people are vested in what would otherwise be a game they don't have an emotional attachment to, but even looking at the team side, you know, I would venture to guess, and you may have the data, you know, it's got to be, sports gambling has to be a top three sponsorship category today. And that didn't even exist 5-6 years ago.
Oh, yeah. With teams, with sports media, that's a huge piece of this story. Yes, you're right. You know, there was a period when FanDuel and DraftKings were outspending all of the American beer industry on marketing.
Crazy.
I don't think they've kept up that pace, but you could see just watching the Super Bowl, you know, one of the most expensive slots right after kickoff was a DraftKings ad. There were constant betting ads throughout the game. And, you know, the fact that they have active players is pretty remarkable, because it seemed for a period like that would be a line that wouldn't be crossed. You wouldn't have current players saying, bet on our games. There was a bit of a workaround when LeBron James was saying, bet on football. And I guess that was allowable. In Canada, they've had some players who are allowed to advertise responsible gaming, but it's kind of like, you know, if you watch a Jack Daniels ad that's all about drinking responsibly, you finish watching the ad and you say, I'd love a glass of bourbon. I think that tends to be the outcome of watching those responsible betting commercials as well. So, yeah. That's just remarkable. And again, a lot of countries don't allow anything like that, and they're just amazed that that's permissible in the U.S.
Well, you bring up a good point. You brought up Europe, and you also brought up Canada and our friends up north. You know, they've had a longer history of sports gambling. And I guess, you know, are there things in addition to some of these restrictions that we can look to Canada or Europe that have actually worked up there to help fix the model here in the U.S.?
Sure. Well, Canada, except for that weird exception with responsible betting, doesn't allow athletes and other celebrities to be spokespeople for these companies. And maybe that would have some impact, because I think a big consequence of that is why kids are suddenly so preoccupied with gambling, and the rate of youth gambling is just stunning. There was a study recently that a third of boys between 11 and 18 have gambled. And I can't imagine it was anything close to that barely a decade ago. That would make an impact. Restrictions on advertising during games, what's sometimes called whistle to whistle. So no betting ads during a game broadcast. That could further limit exposure to kids. definitely these promotions that seduce a lot of new customers and keep a lot of people betting. You know, it's no coincidence that if you take a week break or, you know, a pause in your betting, you're likely to get an email or a push notification saying, hey, here's a deposit match or a odds boost if you come back and keep betting again. All of that could be reined in. And then some stuff that's just outright misleading, like calling some of those promotions risk-free or a slight euphemism, no sweat, when there definitely is risk involved and you definitely will be sweating once you realize you could lose everything you've staked on that bet. All sorts of stuff like that, you know, has been the topic of reform elsewhere in the world. And I think one of the most unforgivable aspects of how legalization took shape in the US, and I know this happens with a lot of American policymaking, was so many states were just totally oblivious and disinterested in learning from other countries, acting like this was this grand American experiment and we would have to have growing pains and figure things out as we go. So many lawmakers and regulators I talked to paid no attention to what could be learned from Britain or Germany or Australia, all these places that have had to rein in the gambling business because things got out of hand for the all of the same reasons we've been talking about. That was just not at all on Americans' minds as they were crafting these laws.
Digging into that a little bit deeper, Danny, as I think about alcohol companies or, you know, back when the advertising rules for nicotine for tobacco companies was, you know, were way more open, there was a bit of a social contract, some of it regulated, some of it more understood, you know, that you don't market to kids, for example, and you don't even underhandedly market to kids. Not that that actually worked, it was violated all the time, but there was a bit of an understanding about that, and groups that would call out companies or media companies that allowed advertising to go further. You know, with that same social dynamic contract in mind, where are we at nowadays with sports gambling?
Yeah, another one that comes to mind is the expectation that bartenders shouldn't overserve someone who's visibly drunk. And there are a lot of equivalents of that with gambling where someone quite visibly is overdoing it or is showing signs of a gambling problem. I was just speaking with a researcher in Austria where all over Europe, these companies have to analyze customer behavior and intervene if they have patterns that seem problematic. That's not the expectation in the US. And that really feels like they're not holding up their end of the bargain by ignoring that side of things. You might say people should be responsible for how they spend their money. And yet, as you were saying, it feels like that responsibility kind of goes both ways. One of the most striking things in my book was just hearing that from people in the industry who feel like they're exploiting people, targeting some of the most vulnerable customers, failing to act when people show signs of a problem, misleading customers in all sorts of ways, from the odds and the likelihood of winning money to how some of these promotions are advertised, on and on. Hearing them say, maybe our companies can't be trusted to self-police, people ought to weigh in and tighten the guardrails, I found that powerful and really convincing.
And before it gets better, you know, there's still a chance it gets worse. Now that we have leagues who are vested and equity partners in sports properties, sports television networks, right? You know, we are losing, unfortunately, some of that independent media, the gatekeepers who are watching over this. So, you know, and I don't know if you can turn on a sports network without there being, you know, a dedicated betting or fantasy show on the air. So, you know, they really are lock in step and right now, and there it just seems to be there needs to be a third party. Maybe it's the government that just looks over and says, okay, there needs to be some governance over what's happening.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a complicated topic, so I don't want to get too in the weeds, but one area where that's so poignant is this so-called integrity monitoring, the supervising of betting activity and flagging and investigating suspicious bets, either signs of fixing or just of athletes and coaches and refs betting when they shouldn't be. And it's such a conflict of interest because those companies The leagues have ownership stakes in those companies. And even worse, their bigger business is facilitating the distribution of data that allows for online betting. So basically, they depend on the success of the betting business. And you think about, yeah, it's one thing if you flag a bench player or even a relief pitcher. If they were to actually catch wind of a superstar who was betting or a major fixing scandal, there would be such a disincentive for them to bring that to the public. I heard that from agents, even from people who work at those companies, that there's so much pressure, if you think about that, for them to sweep something really bad under the rug. And so people talk about maybe there should be a truly independent institution that's responsible for monitoring that data, because trusting the leagues and the betting business to blow the whistle on something that could be devastating for them is quite a leap of faith.
I want to ask you about the league's motivation for allowing this to happen at all. And I know the simple answer, like...
You mean money?
Yeah, well, thank you. I don't even have to say the question. But I'm also wondering about engagement and recruiting fans to either become a fan of a sport or more deeply engage with that sport. So how much does fan engagement and just getting people watching the game, showing up at games, buying jerseys, do you get the sense that plays into the thinking at all here? Or is it simply what John said, money?
Yeah, and that added engagement that is definitely true of fantasy and maybe even more true of gambling. But just thinking about, you know, gosh, all of us who play fantasy football and are obsessing over the backup running back on the Jaguars or whatever, and why would we ever care about that person if it weren't for fantasy sports? That is very appealing to the leagues. But we were talking earlier about how some of that seems so short-sighted. And I think that's a big piece of it, because when I'd speak with people in recovery for gambling problems, I used to hear them say that it got to a point where they loved sports in the first place, and they definitely loved, you know, their childhood team or the home team. And eventually they found they totally lost interest if they weren't betting. If they didn't have skin in the game, no pun intended.
We'll take
and,
it, though.
Yeah. And that sounded really troubling, but like, okay, that's, you know, you have a mental illness at that point. That's extreme. Now I hear that all the time from all sorts of ordinary bettors who say they're just bored by the idea of watching a game if they're not sweating a bet, if they're not in action, as it's sometimes put. And what that means for fandom in the long term, I think, is really interesting, because, you know, the commissioners who used to oppose this, I think some of them had genuine moral opposition, like David Stern in particular seems like someone who genuinely detested gambling. But most of them, you know, obviously they were profit motivated too. I just think they took a longer view of generational fandom, and we're seeing reasons to worry that gambling is a short-term booster, but it long-term, people could burn out or just have such a warped relationship with sports that unless they keep betting, they might lose interest.
Danny, I think that's a great point, and I think that's a scary point for the leagues. I mean, as a former marketing person of sports teams, I want people to come for the love of the game and watching the game and, you know, marveling at the athleticism and the competition, right? Now that you add gambling to it, it kind of dilutes a lot of those great attributes of experiencing sports.
No doubt. One of the interesting reasons why you don't see many gambling ads during the Olympics is because for, you know, many of us, you know, it's so much more obvious that this is a beautiful celebration of sports and so inspiring, and like the purity of the competition and what it represents. You wouldn't want to bastardize that with gambling. And just what that suggests about our willingness to have that influence on games the rest of the year is pretty interesting, just that contrast.
Danny, to wrap us up here, you write at the beginning of the book that, you know, as a journalist who has covered the sports gambling companies, you would occasionally use the apps and you know, connect with what you were writing about, experience it. How did that change your relationship with or your own interest in gambling on sports even at all, even just in the small ways that you were doing, you know, at the outset?
I really haven't bet much in the past year. I was tempted during the Super Bowl. I really felt like the Seahawks were a slam dunk. I didn't pull the trigger. But, you know, it's a combination of two things. One, speaking with professional gamblers and bookmakers and just hearing repeatedly how unbelievably difficult it is to actually win money, and how if you do show that you're a winning bettor, they'll cut you down so you can barely bet pennies. But for those of us who aren't in danger of being limited in that way, it's just the odds are overwhelmingly against us. That, and the idea of lighting my money on fire past a point was unappealing. And the other thing, you know, not to sound holier than thou or anything, but just hearing again from people in the industry, not to mention people in recovery for gambling problems and everywhere in between, how ruthless and in some cases outright predatory these companies can be. At a point, I just didn't feel like patronizing them anymore. And, you know, maybe that'll change, but I'm not interested in giving them my business for now.
We appreciate all the work you put into a topic that John and I have been, we've been talking a lot about this one.
Well, especially as Danny mentioned, after all, this is skin in the game. So yeah. Danny, thanks for bringing this literally to life for us. And in all seriousness, thanks for putting a spotlight on sports gambling. And hopefully with your work and that of others, you know, we can kind of start to turn this ship around a little bit.
Hey, well, thank you both. Really appreciate getting to speak with you.
And we'll be right back on Skin in the Game.
Support for BTPM comes from our members and from Holiday Valley. Holiday Valley was voted the number 4 resort in the East by Ski Magazine readers. More snowmaking, more lifts, more ways to play. Holiday Valley is a mix of exciting terrain on an independent mountain that brings out your best. From the first chair to the last run, Holiday Valley is what winter was made for. Holiday Valley, your winter done right. More information at holidayvalley.com.
Hey, welcome back to Skin in the Game. And again, I want to thank Danny Funt, the author of Everybody Loses, for joining us on Skin in the Game. And I think, Tim, as we talked about with Danny, you know, as our show is titled Skin in the Game, it was overdue that we had this, what I think is a really important conversation on sport betting.
Certainly an appropriate topic for any sports show, including Skin in the Game.
Yeah,
you and I have had so many conversations, you know, when talking about other parts of sports where DraftKings, FanDuel, the different sports books just seem to come up,
well,
right?
ESPN has its own gambling platform.
Yeah,
Caesars
yeah.
has its own gambling platform. I mean, it's... You cannot, you know, turn around. You cannot flip on the television or the radio and whatever without getting inundated by the amount of sports betting promotion out there.
As we know, as Danny writes about in the book, sports betting has been around for, you know, for centuries, and certainly well known for at least, you know, at minimum, the last 100 years, right?
Well, maybe the Roman Empire. Have you ever seen Gladiator, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, you think back to that Chicago White Sox, Chicago, quote-unquote, Black Sox
right.
scandal that in, well, among other things, inspired Field of Dreams. So do you like that movie?
Love it.
Love it. Me too.
And Nine Men Out. That's the Black Sox scandal. Yeah.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, two great movies. You know, a tragic story in the history of sports. But now that it's legal and it's so widely available, and I've thought about this before, but reading Danny's book, which is a really important read, I think, for people. It's one of the ones I truly, truly recommend. And sitting here talking to him, it's like you really got to think about this in the same light as alcohol, you know, or any other vice that's addictive, which is not to say don't gamble or don't drink, as you know. Where's my favorite place at a ski resort?
That's right, Après
ski, right? The quarter of the bar, right?
Yeah.
But in moderation, right? And there's that understanding, that social contract of how do you market this, how don't you?
Yeah, well, the big difference, though, dating back to 1918 with the Chicago Black Sox, and even during, you know, Pete Rose, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, it's technology. You have this app literally in your pocket. And you can bet on a pitch. You can bet on a free throw. You can bet on how long someone's going to take to sing the national anthem.
And which is crazy, right. By the way. But you know, another part of, you know, having that phone in your pocket and the apps that make people and things so accessible. Think about those athletes, pro athletes and college athletes, who are getting death threats for going out there and doing or not doing something they were supposed to do or not do, right, in a game. And, you know, getting death threats for scoring too many points or not enough points or for losing a game. How is that happening? It's usually a DM, a direct message on a social media app.
Yeah, and think about the conflict of interest. And this is where we went with Danny, as a conflict of interest as a fan, right? You know, hypothetically, you bet on your team and you want them to win by over 7 points, right? And right now they're sitting at 6 points. They're on the 5-yard line. There's 30 seconds left. The safe thing to do is for your quarterback to take a knee so no one gets injured. But now that you're a fan and you're betting, you're like, no, quarterback, take that chance. Throw the ball because you need to score 3 more points for me. You see what I mean? That's
right.
There's this conflict between fandom and gambling that, you know, short term, the leagues are generating a ton of revenue. The teams are generating a ton of revenue. But I think long term, you're going to kind of numb the fans to the joy and experience of watching a game.
Yeah. And you talk about even in a stadium, for example, sit and watch it and talk and cheer. You know, you're on your phone making a...
Or here's the irony too, right? We talked about 10 years ago, you know, you couldn't even go to Vegas to watch a live sporting event. Well, now you have sports betting parlors being built into new stadiums. So wait a minute. So think about that. We don't want you in the seat cheering on the home team, but you could go to the corner into the end zone lounge and you can watch NFL Sunday Ticket and you can be betting on all these games. It's just counterintuitive. It's crazy when you think about it.
A while back, I had a conversation with an NFL owner who I strongly suspect was not personally in favor of gambling, maybe not deeply against it, but didn't seem to have any direct interest. They were making plans for a new stadium and said, we want to make sure this is available to our fans. And this was before a single architectural drawing had been made. This was before any pencil hit paper.
So they're building the stadium around the sports betting parlor.
Yeah, I mean it was a very direct reference point.
Wow.
In mind, born of conversations in league committees and in league meetings.
Yeah.
Well, and that's not just the NFL.
As we talked about, I don't think the toothpaste could be put back in the tube, right? But you know, there are things that we can learn from both Canada, Europe, Australia. There needs to be some guardrails on this. And Danny laid out some pretty easy solutions in the short term that we can clean this up. And then really focusing on how do we help those people that got hooked, those people that got addicted to sports gambling because of, It is a drug. It is, and it's an accessible drug because it's always in your pocket, your phone. It's tough, but it's here to stay. And I hope with the work that Danny Funt has done with his book and more people talking about this, we can add some more boundaries because right now everybody is losing.
When I asked him that question, who's losing and who's winning, he did not jump to the conclusion you and I had where it's the leagues. His answer, and that this is the most harrowing point, I think, was essentially, listen, everybody truly, like the title says, everybody is losing. This isn't good for anybody at all. So glad we jumped into this topic on Skin in the Game. I'm quite certain this will not be the last time. I think we'll be back to this one soon, and I think it's going to show up in other conversations.
Absolutely.
Just as it has.
Absolutely. Well, again, thanks to Danny Funt for joining us on the program, and thank you for watching and listening to Skin in the Game. Until next time.